Thank you all for joining us. My name is Stacey Anderson. I'm the policy director for the Montana Primary Care Association. We represent federally qualified health centers in the state, and we serve 1 in 10 patients in Montana with their primary health care needs. So we are one of the sponsoring organizations for these forums. Health Votes Montana is an opportunity and a coalition of groups that come together to provide a chance for communities to learn more from their candidates about their positions on a variety of healthcare issues. So I think you saw all the questions that came forward to us, not only from our sponsoring organizations, but our partnering organizations. And we appreciate that you took the time to prepare for those questions. This is the fourth cycle we've been doing this, and it's this year's Health Votes Forum is sponsored by the Montana Primary Care Association, the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network of Montana, and AARP of Montana. All three of these organizations are nonpartisan. We do not engage in partisan politics or do any candidate endorsements, and yet we're very active and engaged in the healthcare community and discussion that is going on in Montana. So we have a wonderful moderator this evening, Chantel Schieffer. She is the CEO of Leadership Montana, which is a statewide organization building leaders of tomorrow, right? She does amazing work in a statewide organization. She is also this year's Athena Award winner for Bozeman. So we are excited to get to say that. She was in the paper today. She has called Bozeman home for over a decade now and is active in her community and active statewide. And she is thrilled to be here, and we are thrilled that she said yes to be with us. So thank you, Chantel, and she will go over the rules for the forum.
Thank you, Stacey. Welcome, candidates. Welcome, audience members. I just want to start by telling you that we are recording this for KGVM for potentially a later broadcast. So we will continue to use the mics even when we're asking and answering questions from the audience. So the rules of our event here this evening. This is a nonpartisan educational forum designed to help educate candidates about questions that are of concern to Montanans. Each candidate will be given up to 30 seconds to introduce themselves in just a moment. I will ask each candidate running for the same seat the same questions. And each candidate will have up to 90 seconds to answer the question asked. Now, candidates, you don't have to use all 90 seconds. If you do, we might be here for about 4 hours. So, we strongly recommend that you do not repeat other candidates' answers. If you agree with something that you've already heard, simply state that and add any new information. And I also ask the audience to hold your applause until the very end of the evening, and please refrain from making comments or any other distractions. Let's start with candidate introductions, and we start with Mr. Flowers. And this is the same question for everyone. Please state your name, the location of your district, and briefly tell us why you're seeking this office. Mr. Flowers.
My name's Pat Flowers. I'm running for Senate District 32, and that runs from campus west in kind of an expanding mushroom to Four Corners, a little north towards Belgrade, and everything south to West Yellowstone. So it's a big spread out district. I'm running because I have lived in this state now for 41 years. It's given me really an incredible life, and I've lived a life of public service, and I plan to continue that in the legislature. Thank you.
My name is Francis Wendt. I'm also running for Senate District 32. I am in this race because I want to see some real effective change come to Helena. To me, I view that the partisan divide has become untenable in politics lately, and I'm really working to try and make sure that is. I'm a military member, and I continuously and wholeheartedly support and serve the people.
Well, thank you all. My name is Jedediah Hinkle, and again, Senate District 32, and you know the borders of that. I went to the legislature with really no expectations, and I spent 2 years vastly learning. They say it's like drinking out of a fire hose, and I'd say it's like drinking out of 5 fire hoses. Not only do you have to learn the process, but you have to learn all the issues. And I have learned many issues. I've learned the process, and you know, this go-around, I have good relationships with both Republicans and Democrats in the legislature, and quite honestly, I just want to carry on and apply myself. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm J.P. Pomnikowski. I am your Montana State Senator for District 33. Welcome to my district. We are right in the heart of it. The district runs from just west of, or just east of Four Corners as the west border, all the way across town to Rouse Avenue. And then just north of campus, all the way north to the interstate. So all of the new elementary schools, high school, a lot of new neighbors. Stop already? Really? Holy shnikes. Please vote Pom Nikowski.
Hi, I'm Jim Hamilton. I'm the incumbent representative in House District 61, which is basically from Rouse east to the Park County line. My particular interest in the legislature is I'm sitting on the tax committee, been on the Revenue and Transportation Interim Committee, and I think there's a lot more work we still need to do in terms of making a rational and fair budget and fair taxation, and that's really where I want to spend my time.
I'm Denise Albrecht. I'm running for House District 64, which is West Yellowstone, Big Sky, Gallatin Gateway, and Four Corners area. I'm a first-time candidate. I decided to get off the sidelines, and you know, I was frustrated with how things were going at the national level, and I decided I'm jumping into the race. So here I am.
Hi, my name is Dr. Jane Gillette, and I'm a researcher and healthcare consultant. My area of expertise is health disparities, primary disease prevention, and also translational science. I studied value-based healthcare at Harvard within the Institute of Strategy and Competitiveness, and I serve on a Montana nonprofit board. I founded a nonprofit about 7 years ago now where we provide free community-based services to veterans, the homeless, and disadvantaged children and the elderly. And for fun, I still maintain a very small dental practice caring for patients in nursing homes. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Chris Pope, and I'm running as a candidate for House District 65, where we're seated right now. So welcome to the district. The district runs from Rouse all the way out almost to Black Bull, to Gooch Hill. And north from Durston, say, state. I am running partly because I was a cancer survivor in 2013, and I reordered all of my priorities, and I thought that my next best step was to do something I've been thinking about a long time, is to do public service, and that's all I can say tonight. So thank you.
Hello, Seth Mangini. I'm running for House District 68, which starts a little ways behind Target, runs out to the Gallatin River, and then goes from I-90 south to Hulbert Lane. So kind of between Bozeman and Belgrade, touches both communities. I've thought a long time about maybe getting involved in politics, and I was raised as a Boy Scout, and you were taught you didn't just sit on the sidelines. You tried to fight for the things that you believe in. So here I am.
My name is Bruce Grubbs, and I'm the incumbent in House District 68. And thank you, Seth, for describing where the district is so I have more time. But I think I learned a lot the first session. I think I can be a lot more effective this session. I've served in public service as a school board member in Bozeman since 2001. And I originally ran for the legislature to really promote and improve public education in Montana. Thank you.
Thank you. So we will start with our questions tonight, and this first round of questions will be asked of every one of you. And we'll start with question number two. This question, and we'll start with Representative Grubbs. You'll be the first to answer, and we'll go right down the line. Representative Grubbs, most Montanans want to stay in their homes and communities as they age, even when health challenges occur. People who qualify for Medicaid are entitled to nursing home care, but the Medicaid program that provides care in a home or in an assisted living residence is limited and has a long waiting list. Given the high cost of nursing home care and the lower average costs of care in homes or assisted living, how would you expand seniors' opportunities for services in their homes and in their communities?
I have personal experience with this. My mother died in Bozeman from Alzheimer's in 2012, and we had to find a place for her. She qualified for Medicaid, but it was a long process. And my mother-in-law has Alzheimer's right now, and she's in an assisted living in Bozeman. So it's very important. There's a couple ways we can keep people in their homes. One is increasing the waiver slots available. Obviously, if our priority is to put people in nursing homes, which is more expensive, that's the reverse of where it should be. We should put people where they're most comfortable and where the care is more efficient. And so increasing waiver slots is one way. Also, we need to increase pay for direct care providers so that we have more providers in the community. I supported Representative Kanoki's bill last session to increase pay for providers and increase that provider pool. So that would be a couple ways I would work on that.
Thank you. Mr. Mangini, same question.
Thank you. Yeah, unfortunately, this has also been an issue that has affected my family deeply. Both grandparents on my mother's side and a beloved aunt had various forms of dementia. Medicaid, the greatest solution. It's better than nothing. The poverty requirements obviously require that you use up your life savings, and it doesn't take long for a life savings to go away. It's not always cheaper to keep people in their homes, but it should be. I mean, it can be $27 an hour for daytime care, $29 at night. So it depends on if they need 24-hour care. So I do like the idea of keeping more slots. In the long run, a healthier society will also have lower Alzheimer's rates. For instance, diet can increase your risk of Alzheimer's up to 50%. Americans like their meat and potatoes, you know, so long-term, you know, healthier lifestyles help. So,
thank you. Mr. Pope, same question.
Well, I would be very much in support of an effort to push healthcare into the communities and into homes. And I think that's generally the spirit of where I think we're going to find much improved healthcare and lower cost, obviously, as it says. And I would be very much in support of a bill to address shifting the patients to home care where appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
It's a good question, by the way. So aging in place really begins with designing the environment properly. So the AARP actually has an initiative to develop friendly aging communities, and we recently, this past year, had a forum which was hosted by GAR to begin the conversation about how we might develop more age-friendly communities. Age-friendly communities include having walkable options for people, that streets that are safe and easy for the elderly to maneuver through. Of course, having appropriate housing and transportation is important. And, of course, access to services that they need and being able to participate meaningfully in their community. I don't know if you might know Cheryl Bartholomew, who's been quite a champion for age-friendly communities. And right now, the city is conducting a needs assessment on this topic, and there'll be a second community event where we'll be able to discuss these opportunities. Of course, I echo what Bruce Grubb said about supporting direct care workers and making sure that their wages are appropriate and they're qualified, and, of course, increasing waiver slots as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Albrecht.
Years and years and years ago, it used to be when you grew up and you were born and raised, you lived in the same town where your parents lived, and then people were, as they got older, they had siblings who lived in the same city. So when your parents got older, they had like four or five siblings, three siblings who lived in the same area. That doesn't happen now. So kids move in a different state, different town than their parents do when they get elderly. So it's important not only that people know the resources out there, that they're educated on where the resources are and tap into those. And the elderly population is increasing in the state. And so it's really important that we do take care of our elderly and try to support not only them in their home, but also the caregivers as well.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. You know, I think one of the things inherent in this question is sort of the average cost of care in homes and assisted living. And I've spent 35 years as a financial advisor and sold a lot of long-term care insurance, talked to a lot of clients who ended up needing care, and there's limits to that lower average cost in the home because it is, once you, as Mr. Mangini said, once you get to extensive care, you're going to end up with extensive costs. So I think we really need to think a little bit about the affordability issue. Ideally, we'd like people to be in their homes or be in assisted living situations, but how are we going to do that? I think we can be a little bit innovative here and see if we can't figure out some type of insurance plan that might be helpful. Maybe the state can participate in that in some way, to allow people to get very low cost insurance, which at some point down the road would allow them to spend more time in their home, pay for the care, pay for assisted living. I think that's one thing. The second thing is I think we need a package that looks at more than just the affordability issues. So for example, we need to assist caregivers. How do we make their lives work when they're doing all this care? How about a long-term plan to make care better, more affordable? And transportation issues would be another one. My last one would be, I think often to stay in your own home, you need an advocate who can go with you to the doctor and help you understand the plan that you've got to live with.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
Thank you for the question. So for the 2 points that the question first asks, we are an aging state. We are one of the most quickly aging states in the nation, and so we will have more people that need more advanced care and more care. I think what we need to focus on is in a state as large as ours, with a lot of rural communities, it is not so easy to assume that there is a place for someone, even if we could open waiver slots. Now, that is not to say that I believe that we do need a Medicaid program that offers more slots and more waivers for people. We also need, if people want to age in their homes, which is a much more familiar and less stressful environment for a lot of people, there need to be direct care workers available to help them. In small communities, that's a challenge. So for the vast array of population centers and very, very remote centers of people, we need all levels of care. The legislature has worked on this. We funded more direct care and critical care hospitals in remote areas. We have advocated for more Medicaid funding for this. The short answer is, if we want in-home care and more Medicaid waivers, we need to fund the programs.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
Well, I think we ought to just get back to the basics. Medicaid was originally created to assist individuals with disabilities and senior citizens. But when I think of Medicaid expansion, I think of Social Security in the sense that it was rated. Because Medicaid expansion was not categorically expanded, it was vertically expanded. And when you do that, you have individuals who, for instance, may be able to work or may be childless, that work less or unwilling to work, that actually take these benefits away from the people that this program was designed to cover. So I think if Medicaid ends up sunsetting, then I think we ought to take those resources and apply it to this situation with senior citizens to make sure that we bring that list down. Because from what I understand, the list was long before Medicaid was expanded, and the list is longer now.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt.
Yeah, I'm going to take this a little bit personally because my father passed away from his fourth type of cancer last year in 2017, September. For 4 years into that, my sister forewent work and she provided in-home care for my father, and he was able to pass away at his own decision in his home. So one of the things that I look at is that the question is, yes, children move away. Yes, we have an aging citizenry, but how much does the government need to be providing for that? As Senator Hinkle said, it was originally designed for a very narrow scope, and it's been expanded, and it's been expanded. Eventually, I'm one of the few millennials on this panel here, and I'm looking at the cost of this when I come and 40 years later, what am I going to be paying for? And that's really what I concern myself with, because my goal is not to look at how do we cover the next 4 years, how do we cover the next 8 years. My goal is how do we cover the next 40 years, because that's really what we need to do.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. Obviously, this is, I think, relevant to all of us who've had family members face this. And it's relevant to me. As Francis mentioned, someday, hopefully a ways down the road, I'll be facing the same reality, or my kids will, with me. And I've watched what a dilemma it is for a family to face the financial consequences as well as the kind of emotional challenges that a family faces in trying to figure out the appropriate care for their parent. So I think it's incredibly important. I think there are no easy solutions. Like every one of your questions here, I think there's probably been several PhDs written on each of these. And I think really we're just scratching the surface on possible solutions. I would echo Representative Hamilton's recommendation on trying to find more opportunity for long-term health insurance. I've actually looked into that. It's virtually unavailable at this point, which is too bad. And I think we need to work with insurance companies to try and find ways to make that more of a possible reality. Beyond that, I'd also appreciate or would support ways to provide better pay for healthcare workers that are working with our elders. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for staying within the time, allotted time. Our next question, we'll start with Mr. Flowers and work our way back down. It's question number 12. Given the budget crisis this past year for behavioral health in Montana, would you support funding behavioral health in Montana with a consistent revenue stream, either through an income tax over $1 million or some other consistent method?
I feel like I'm in the fantasy football draft where I've got the last slot, but I get to draft twice. So here I am. If you've never played fantasy football, it's a lot of fun. I'm glad you asked the question. I think it's a great one. We altered our income tax fundamentally in 2003, flattened it, went from 10 income tax brackets down to 7. And that we went from a range of taxes from 2% to 11%, and we reduced it down to a max of 6.9%. So now someone who's making just over minimum wage, $17,100, is paying the same marginal tax rate as somebody paying or earning a million plus, whatever, beyond 17,000. Everybody's paying the same marginal tax rate. We've lost, because of that, over a 10-year period from 07 to 16, we lost chose to forego about $1 billion in tax revenue, and we're paying the price for that right now. I think whether the solution is focusing on 1 million plus or 500,000 plus, as the governor recommended, I think we need to look at that tax structure, and I think it can be a useful solution for funding mental health. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt.
So mental health and behavioral health services was something that I was a major proponent of when I ran in 2016. I've been hit by suicide very much in my life. And it comes down to the fact of this is an epidemic here in Montana and we need to address it. But the question is, do we raise the taxes or do we find carve outs in other areas of the budget? The budget was a major issue last year. 2017, it required a second session to balance the budget as required by Montana Constitution. And so we can say we want everything, but we have to really pick and choose what we want. I think behavioral health is a major thing that we need to address. I think we need to put some money into research, but it has to come from other areas of the budget. And we can't just blanket say we're going to create more tax brackets. We're going to create this. I personally pay 33% of my income, and I am in low income. So when you're telling me that we need more taxes, I don't buy it. I really don't. So, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
Well, you wanted a me too, and I'd have to say me too with Mr. Wendt here. But no, it is, you know, one of our jobs in the legislature is to balance everything. And I understand that you know, every special interest out there wants all that they can for their interest, but we have to balance the needs of everyone. With that, you know, mental health is a very important issue, and, you know, my position on it is that we really need to focus on prioritizing what does the state want this time, and but we can't have everything. So that's my me too.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
Where shall I start? A fellow legislator, I think, has encapsulated this by saying, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. So for whatever crisis in someone's life needs attention, we must address that. I cannot imagine a more crying need than to give someone the help they need at whatever crisis moment so that not everything stops right there. Now, when we talk about the budget, the special session was called because we had the largest wildfire season in this state's history and had to address that. The cuts we made were to programs that just didn't deserve to be cut. They did not deserve to be cut. Behavioral health and mental health services, senior services, in-home care services, special needs, all of those services are critically important and they did not deserve to be cut. They were the programs that were targeted. They must be funded back and more amply than they were. We will not have less of a need for mental health or behavioral health services. There won't be less need. We have more people all the time. We have more stress all the time. So whatever the funding model is, and if there are sessions where we must address a budget crisis, we will address that. But that must, the lower level that we have established must not be the level going forward.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. I'd like to agree with the good senator on the one particular issue, which is the sooner we deal with the behavioral health issues, the less they're going to cost us in total. And we need to deal with them now. You know, we've talked about a lot of different issues here of already of senior care and Medicaid expansion and so forth. I think one of the things that we're missing is the importance of agreeing across party lines, what are we willing to fund and what is most important to us. Let's talk about the priorities. It's foolishness to talk about we can't have everything. Nobody's saying we should have everything. It's foolishness to talk about we're just going to have to cut more out of the budget. If you look at our budget, we have a very, very tight budget. And if you look, we've been hearing that excuse in Montana for the last 25 years. For 25 years, we've been hearing, we just need to cut a little bit more. We need to tighten our belt a little bit more. If there was a lot of room to be tightening our belt, we would have done that already in 25 years. So I think we need to change that focus from talking about what we can't do to agreeing on what we can do and want to do and what we find to be the most important thing. I don't think we should tie it to a specific revenue stream because I think that bails us out of decision making. And lastly, I would say last session I carried a bill to eliminate the capital gains preference for those who make more than $1 million a year. Would have affected 400 people in this state. We could have funded a whole lot of service.
Thank you. Ms. Albrecht.
There's an estimated 42,000 people that have a serious mental illness in the state of Montana. It's important that we understand mental illness. We work with prevention on mental illness. Where does that start? When does that start? That can start in early childhood programs. It can start in elementary schools. It can start when we see children and families who are struggling. And when you add poverty and difficulty with parents with some type of mental illness, it can be an issue, and it starts early. So we need to, you know, fund our education, make sure we have a good quality education, support those early prevention programs because they will help us later on. Also, we need to be very efficient, like Jim was saying, very efficient with the money that we have, with the resources that we have, to be efficient with the programs that we have.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
So mental health parity, of course, is vitally important, not just on the individual level, but also for our economy as well. And the short answer to the question, I think it's asking, you know, would I consider an income tax over $1 million? And I think I'd be willing to consider all ideas that are available. I think that's our duty to consider them. I'd also echo what Jim said about not tying it to a revenue source. I think that's a smart idea as well. One thing to note just about the revenue that comes into the state, that increasingly our property taxes and income taxes have been disproportionately represented within our income stream. So, for instance, within the past two decades, those have doubled, while other revenue streams in Montana have not had as much growth. So I think looking at other options and opportunities for generating revenue are important as we have these conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Pope.
Thank you. I would agree that we need to spend considerable time thinking about our sources of revenue at the state level. For a variety, a long list of very important programs. This certainly is one. I feel that the preventative and wellness side of the equation on mental health is right in front of us. We have to move the state away from the institutional care concept and move, especially for rural areas, into wellness programs for folks. I don't believe that this is a special interest issue. I think this affects virtually every Montanan. I'm not a fan of trying to attach this to an income tax piece because I think it's very vulnerable to being reversed out. You know, what happened last session was unconscionable. And this is one of the things that I'm going to Helena to try and correct. It's not a individual thing. It's a group effort. It's a team effort. I think there's bipartisan interest in this, especially on in rural areas and on the Native American communities. We've got, you know, it's not an embarrassment. It's an outrage. And at this point, I'm going to do everything I can. I think we need to get back to the baseline level of funding. And then probably double or triple it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mangini.
You'll have to excuse me. I'm a Forest Service trail guide, but for some reason spending an entire summer in the woods not interacting with real humans leaves you nervous when you're in front of even a small crowd. It's a really funny thing. That being said, I think that mental health should be one of the lowest priorities of things we would ever cut. In fact, I don't think we should ever cut it. I think it should be inviolatable. I would support higher taxes on upper income to pay for it, not directly tied to it, but I think that that is a very, of the things that we can raise revenue from, that's one of the most obvious, and I don't think it's too much to ask. One of the other things I wanted to say on the last one was reiterating about long-term care insurance. It shouldn't always have to fall on Medicaid. It shouldn't be the only way we pay for long-term care for older people, and I think having some kind of insurance program, whether it's subsidized or not, would be probably the best way to do that.
Thank you. Representative Grubbs.
So being last, I think everything's been said, but I'll take a little bit from everyone. Mental health services need to be one of the top priorities. In fact, our entire safety net for vulnerable people need to be a high priority in our budget. With that said, I don't believe that it should just be tied to one tax, like an income tax over $1 million. One of my priorities this session, I know a lot of legislators are talking about this, is looking at our entire revenue structure in the state. We've had a lot of shifting from natural resource development and royalties on minerals to tourism. And so we need to be looking at a lot of different issues with revenue. I know property taxes, as Dr. Gillette said, have doubled probably in the last 10, 15 years. So we need to look at the whole revenue structure. But also, as Representative Hamilton said, I don't think it should be tied to one revenue stream. I think it should be the legislature's responsibility to fund these out of the budget by prioritizing. And I, you know, for one, think it's the highest priority. Another issue, I work with public schools in my job I just retired with, and they're having a hard time finding mental health providers because of pay. So,
thank you. Okay, our next question, we'll start with Representative Grubbs, is question number 3. Increasing health care costs affects everyone, from individuals, employers, communities, and the state. Preventing illness and disease can help in controlling costs. Tobacco use remains the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. It causes cancer and other diseases, costing millions in health care expenditures each year. Over 20% of teenagers self-reported using electronic smoking devices, such as e-cigarettes, vape pens, e-hookahs, etc. Effective strategies to prevent tobacco use include tobacco tax increases, prohibiting the use of electronic smoking devices where smoking is prohibited, and tobacco prevention and cessation programs that lead to significant reductions in youth use. Raising the legal age to purchase tobacco products is another strategy aimed to reduce the number of kids and young adults who start smoking. Please share with us your views on these strategies.
So tobacco, we learned, we were at Bozeman Health this morning, and John Hill, the CEO, gave us a statistic that every taxpayer in Montana is paying almost $800 to support people who smoke and the health care costs that all of us share. It's a huge issue, and now with the vaping and other devices, people that I never, you know, kids I never saw smoking, they're all doing it. I have nephews that, well, smoking's bad, but we can do this. It's terrible. So I would support, you know, raising the age. I would support a tobacco tax. That's something that's hard for me. I don't like to raise taxes, but it's a disincentive to smoke. And there's a fine line about raising it too much or not enough. You need to give enough disincentive to get more people to quit, especially kids. If there's a huge price, they're not going to spend their money on it. But also, you don't want to put a burden on those people that are lifetime smokers and are having a hard time and maybe low income. We need more help in schools with education and also more people that can work with longtime smokers.
Thank you. Mr. Mangini.
I look forward to the day when nobody smokes. A great day, I think, for all of us. And I fully support a tobacco tax. I'd like to see those guys go out of business. I support public relations to show people just how uncool it is. That being said, I'm also an ex-smoker, and I understand the people in their teens and early 20s are going to experiment, and they're going to do things that, you know, you wouldn't do later when you think about it. And something that nobody really talks about is the nicotine levels in cigarettes and how much that has gone up over time. And I think we need to regulate it down so that if you do decide to smoke and later in life you're like, you know, maybe I want to be able to hike without losing my breath, or maybe I don't want people to be grossed out when they smell me, you can actually quit. And from what I hear, the FDA is actually moving in that direction, and anything we can do to encourage that and just make it a really bad-tasting campfire in your mouth and not an addictive habit, we should do.
Thank you. Mr. Pope.
Yes, thank you. I would definitely support a bill to raise the legal age for tobacco. Other statistics we heard this morning, 41 million packs of cigarettes are sold annually in Montana. That was alarming. $350 million, the $779 per person comes out to $350 million in cash costs for tobacco-related illness. You know, normally I'm sort of more of an entrepreneur, incentives-oriented type. I think we've got, you know, as a society, you can read books on this. You know, for the last 50 years, we've had all kinds of campaigns to do this and do that to disincentivize smoking, and here we are. We still have a massive fire on deck, in my opinion. That $350 million would go an awful long way. Some of the other things we're talking about tonight. You know, I'd be very interested in something that's pretty hard-edged and that's very compassionate. It is an addiction, and yet I think the state of Montana has enough data here to create a plan to step everybody off. And, you know, we have to decide whether we're going to live with those kind of numbers. I just can't imagine it. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
I can tell you from serving on a health insurance board in Montana that the cost related to tobacco is great for all of us, even if we don't smoke. Currently, there are over 340 cities and counties in 21 states across the nation who have the age limit as 21. And as a healthcare practitioner, of course, I deeply support moving the age to 21. And I can tell you that the science is very good on this as well, that it does work. It does help decrease smoking in younger adults for sure. And that I believe that that control actually belongs in the local community. So it wouldn't necessarily, in my mind, be a state policy, but it would be a local issue giving control to cities and counties who really know and understand their areas and their communities best. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Albrecht.
Even though, if you think about years and years and years ago, where smoking was and tobacco, we've actually come a long way in regards to the education about tobacco. We can't smoke in bars, airplanes, airports. So even though we've made a lot of progress, it's still important that we haven't made enough. I mean, we know one thing about tobacco. It does harm you. It can kill you. And so this is a way that we can prevent it. I'm also, with a lot of people on the panel here, support increase in age of buying tobacco. And I would also support the tobacco tax. Even though I do have an issue of it somewhat targeting a group of people, you know, but I would be in favor of supporting it.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. I'll join the others who are talking about raising the legal age to 21. Doing a little bit of research, I found at least four states, New Jersey, Hawaii, California, and Maine, who have an age 21. I don't know why we couldn't join them. A bigger concern for me is the whole process of vaping and the sort of the myths around that, that it's going to be a tool to allow people to stop smoking. There's some recent research that said for teens who start vaping, they are more likely to progress to tobacco, to actual, they have a word for it, but cigarettes that burn, whatever the right word is there. And that adults are actually less likely to quit who vape than those who don't. So some of the myths around that, I think, need to be talked about a little bit more. We need a little bit more education on that. Wouldn't hurt my feelings at all if we eliminated vaping products. I'm not sure that's even possible to do, but kids are the top target of that, and I just think that's a very wrong thing to do. Marketing tobacco substitutes online is another big problem. I think that should be eliminated. I think our real efforts should be aimed at stopping it before it gets started. Raising tobacco taxes would give us an opportunity to continue more in the cessation programs, though.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
I agree with much that has been said. One point of which is increasing the tax on tobacco products and also other inhalants, so vaping products and that kind of, and also and snuff and the rest of the tobacco products, for the purpose of preventing someone from starting. But I've always had a bit of a moral dilemma in taxing addiction. Right, addiction is not a voluntary thing, and so the way that I have been persuaded over many years of hearing about this issue is that there is a nexus between taxing a product and then providing for programs that can help people beat that addiction. That's important to me. It never did seem fair that someone would propose taxing tobacco to use for paving roads, right? Sure, smokers drive too. I get it. But that's not what we're talking about. So if someone really wants to beat an addiction, and they're addicted and they're paying into a tax, then there should be a program for that person, for those people. We also in the state have a Clean Indoor Air Act, which has been very effective. And for people who are not tobacco users, we and a lot of Montanans also suffer from the effects of tobacco. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
I don't completely agree with all the premise of the question. I don't think it's correct to lump together vaping and tobacco. I was actually on a committee last session in Judiciary Committee where that Indoor Air Act came before us. And honestly, I knew nothing of this issue. And so it was a total learning process for me. But what I realized was that, you know, one is smoking, one is not. One is tobacco, one is not. One contains the chemicals that lead to cancer, and the other one doesn't. And there was, in that committee, there was over, I think, 50 studies presented talking about how actually health improvements with vaping versus, I guess, the counter that says that there's chemicals and things like that that would cause more problems. And so, you know, I've talked to a number of people since then. I've heard a lot of stories on how, you know, their breathing is better and how they've actually been able to quit tobacco. So I just don't think that lumping the two together is the correct thing. But I would not support a tax increase. Senator Pomnikowski, I don't believe in funding the government off the backs of people's addictions. And I do agree with Representative Grubbs that education in school is incredibly important. And I remember the DARE program when I was in school, and I think we can be incredibly effective there. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt.
So I'm going to go ahead and disagree with most of what's been said on the panel here. I am a smoker. I am the pariah of the group here. I've smoked since I was 18. I actually didn't start smoking until I was 18, until I joined the military. It's a stress management tool, and I think we're looking at this the very wrong way. This is very tied to behavioral health. It is an addiction. It is a lot of things. And one of the most driving factors of stress of the people that I associate with is economic disparity. And when you're saying you're going to add $2 to a tax to try and curb this problem, what you're really going to do is you're going to push more people to actually go and hit financial rock bottom and then start considering suicide. That's what you're going to do. So, no, I don't support any of this. And when you're talking about raising the legal age of purchasing, when are we going to start realizing that if they can vote for someone, they can make decisions for their own life? The government cannot manage someone's risk that they take for themselves. We have to be able to have a little bit of a hands-off there. So the long and the short is the best method to look at this is look at the underlying factors that are causing this, not necessarily the addiction or the tax or the cost.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
There's no question that tobacco... Is this on? Yeah, okay. It's on. It's affecting us all and our costs day in and day out. Somebody quoted the numbers earlier. I think, though, it's unfair to only focus on tobacco use. There's other preventable diseases that are nearly as expensive for the rest of us. Hypertension, obesity, and that's certainly becoming more prevalent in our society. So I think if we're going to address tobacco use and try and find ways to curb that, to reduce the healthcare costs of all of us, I think we need to take a broader look. And obviously, if you do that, that's a slippery slope, because then how do you address people's eating habits? Are we going to regulate eating habits? Are we going to regulate other things that affect hypertension? Probably not. So I think it's just mind as we consider regulating tobacco use. That said, it sounds like, from what I've read, the cessation programs and education programs that are already on board with Department of Health and Human Services have been very effective, so I'd certainly support those. And I think the tobacco tax, I have some of the same moral dilemmas that JP cited as well. Thank you.
Thank you. For the next question, we're going to change our order just a bit and actually start in the middle with Ms. Albrecht. So if you wouldn't mind passing the microphone down to her. So this is question number 7. Montana's Medicaid expansion sunsets in July 2019. Are you in favor of removing the sunset? And if you are, how would you suggest it is funded?
Well, nothing like a tough question for a rookie. Medicaid expansion, I usually define as Montana healthy kids. I think some people think of Medicaid or Medicaid expansion and think maybe not so, I don't know, they might have not the best reputation as a Medicaid does. In saying that, I know I have just a few minutes. I would be in support of expanding healthy Montana kids. And I would think it helps kids with families who are going through a divorce and the mother is now a single mother with two kids and she needs to find insurance. She needs to go on Medicaid, and hopefully Medicaid expansion just encompasses a whole group of people. You know, 90,000 people are on Medicaid expansion, Montana healthy kids. One out of 10 people in this room, I think most of us know somebody who's benefiting from that program. And it's really important to maintain it. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
I'm in favor of removing the sunset. However, I do think that reforms need to be made. In ACA, the asset test was taken away. And unfortunately, that opened up a whole new set of issues. I talk to providers relentlessly every week who say that they will stop taking Medicaid because they believe that the patients that they're serving actually have assets. And I could tell you some pretty amazing stories there. So I think one way to deal with that would be to submit a Medicaid waiver, a 115 Medicaid waiver. So those Medicaid waivers are available to states for testing different approaches that are not allowed by law currently. And so one opportunity might be to submit a waiver to CMS and request that the asset test be either modified or maybe a modest asset test of maybe $5,000. Of course, I think that we should be looking at cost sharing as well, and that could be put in the waiver. An obvious choice for ongoing funding is I-185, which I do support. And of course, as we talked about just a little bit ago, we always, at least in my opinion, need to be thinking about new revenue streams that just increasing property tax and income tax is not a sustainable model for us. So we need to be thinking about other opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pope.
Well, I'm pleased to say there's a lot of agreement for the candidates of House District 65. Well done. You know, I fully support the extension of Medicaid expansion. I voted for Medicaid expansion. This was one of my proud votes in 2015. Oh boy, do we have a lot of work to do in healthcare. It represents 35% of the state budget. There's so many areas where we need to get into very detailed discussions about what needs to happen. I don't think Medicaid's, it's something that we need to continue with. I'm thankful that it's there. But I'm also really aware that we need to tighten down and deliver more services for lower cost, and we're not anywhere close. We are being outpaced by our neighboring states, and it's just because I'm a business guy, I'm not a healthcare person. I don't know what the answers are, but I'm very concerned about the delivery of services at affordable cost. So Medicaid right now needs to be extended. I'm all in for 185, but I'm all in also for a pretty massive rethink about how we're doing business in Montana on health care. I think we can do much better. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Mangini.
Yes, I support removing the sunset clause, and I also support I-185. We do worry about how cost increases down the line will go. I think the current projections only go 2 or 3 years, and so we could be facing where all of a sudden rising Medicaid costs do blow a hole in the state's budget. So we do need to keep that in mind. Other revenue sources, sin taxes are always the least unpopular. Perhaps something on alcohol, gambling, these things, they might be able to help give a little extra padding for the Medicaid budget. So, and we need to be able to, not just people on Medicaid, because that's very, very low income. You know, we have the ACA, but with cost increase in the ACA, you know, you really have to be making $40,000, $50,000 a year before you can comfortably be buying your own health insurance and affording those premiums, which is pretty scary for a lot of people. And I think we need to have an option for the in-between people, whether that's some kind of other subsidized insurance or something along those lines. We need to think about that group too, the person that's just over the line for Medicaid.
Thank you. Representative Grubbs.
So I pretty much agree with both candidates. I think House District 65. Dr. Gillette made some good points about asset testing. So the HELP Act, a sunset was put on it so that the legislature could look back and see how well it was working. That's why the sunset happened, so that their legislature could revisit it. The HELP Act had job training, funds to help people get better jobs so they could pay for health care. I know the utilization was fairly low, but, you know, the requirements on asset tests, work requirements I would support. Also the efficiencies that former Representative Pope brought up. We need to look at efficiencies in Medicaid delivery and see how we can save money. I also think the federal portion of Medicaid, since we got the waiver for our Medicaid expansion, was a lot higher than it was before that. So I'm not exactly sure. I haven't studied it, how much more money we've been paying, but I'm not sure we've been paying a lot more. So I think we could find the money with, you know, asset tests, work requirements, and also looking at efficiencies and delivery. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Well, I do support reauthorizing expanded Medicaid. Even at that point, the state's only covering 10% of the cost, and the federal government's still covering 90%. So for the nearly 100,000 people in Montana who now have health insurance that didn't have it before we expanded Medicaid, I think that's a relatively small price to pay. I recognize it's still a large sum of money. I think a big portion of that will be covered by 85, and despite my moral dilemma that I described earlier, I will vote in support of I-185 as well for that reason. One thing that I think should be in the discussion either is the fact that not only has this been good for the nearly 100,000 people who now have health insurance, but it's also been quite an economic boost for the state. If you haven't seen the study that was done by Bureau of Business and Economic Research on those economic impacts, I encourage you to take a look at it. They estimate that between 2018 and 2020, it will result in 5,000 jobs from it, from that investment, and $270 million in additional income in Montana. So I think that's not to be overlooked as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt.
So I have a really different opinion on the medical system and how it's all been controlled. Some of the statistics that Mr. Flowers has been put, 5,000 jobs, that's 0.5% of the population of Montana. 100,000, that's 10%. So we're talking about 90% paying for 10%. That's what we're talking about here. And then there was another statistic that was quoted over there that the Montana budget is, healthcare is 35% of the Montana budget. I don't have health care. I will tell you that right now. I can't afford it, even under the Affordable Care Act, and I'm 36. There's a lot of people that live in this. So we can talk about this house of cards that we're building and the authorization and the insurance and all of that, but I want to be very clear with you. There are many, many people who just, this goes in one ear and out the other. They don't understand it. They don't get it. They are not financial advisors. They don't worry about acid tests. This just, it's a lot of gibberish to a lot of people.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
Thank you. So I have a friend who is on Medicaid and public assistance. And, you know, we talked about job opportunities, ways that she could work out of it. And what she told me was that she would have to get a job that was probably paid $17, $18 an hour after taxes and with the living expenses. That's what she would need in order to cover the expenses she has. And she said, I can't go get a job for $10 an hour or $12 an hour, because once I cross that line, that 150% of the federal poverty level, I lose all my benefits. And that's not going to sustain me and my husband's needs. So the problem is people in those situations actually look for lower paying jobs, and they look for temporary income, because they don't want to cross over that threshold because they lose their benefits. So in a sense, the current Medicaid system will hold people in a type of financial slavery. I think that we should be talking about reforming Medicaid to where people can actually work out of the system without losing all of their benefits. And then the other problem is what I discussed before, where Medicaid was expanded vertically rather than categorically. I do support the sunset, and I think we ought to take those funds that we save and we ought to put it towards individuals that the program was originally designed to protect.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
An important thing to remember is that if someone doesn't have health coverage, that doesn't mean they don't cost us for their health care. And so almost 100,000 people in Montana, just imagine that. That's 2.5 Bozemans of people have health coverage now that didn't. I support I-185 for a funding mechanism going forward for more people to be covered, have health care coverage under a program that is called Medicaid expansion. Doesn't matter what it's called. It's that people now have health coverage that didn't have it before. I also, I would dearly love a better healthcare model. And until we have it, this is what we have. So I will support this one and try to expand this one and try to cover as many people as possible for as many procedures and preventive care and crisis care and emergency care and whatever else they need until we have a better model, socialized healthcare. What else? Oh, the sunset. So the sunset was placed so that we would intentionally look at this policy, and the legislature will. I think it's vitally important that we recognize that if we don't continue this, those 100,000 people, 96,000 people that have health care coverage now, won't.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
I am in favor of removing the sunset, and I am in favor of I-185, so I'll be quick on those. But I don't think we can talk about it in isolation. I think Francis has a point, and the point is we also need to be thinking about healthcare costs and how do we control costs, how do we get costs down and deliver that service to even more people. You know, I often hear, we hear this a lot in the legislature about Medicaid or Medicaid expansion and how people are taking advantage of it. And frankly, I think that's a myth. We never, ever hear numbers about who supposedly doesn't deserve to be on Medicaid. We hear a lot of anecdotes. We hear a lot of stories about one's next-door neighbor, but we don't hear numbers. And my suspicion is if we actually did hear the numbers, what we'd find is the vast majority of the people who are receiving Medicaid services really do need those services. The other thing that I would mention with that Pat Flowers had said is the economic impact may be small in terms of number of jobs, but approximately $300 million worth of money flowing into the Montana economy gets washed through in a lot of different ways, not just in the creation of new jobs. So it's the right thing to do for people's health care, and it's the right thing to do for our state economically. To remove the sunset, vote for I-185, and let's move on to improving healthcare costs.
Thank you. The next question, we'll start with you, Representative Hamilton, and move to your right. It is question number 8. The Children and Families Health and Human Services Interim Committee continues to have policy discussions focusing on the needs of people with Alzheimer's and dementia and their family caregivers. Alzheimer's and dementias are some of the most expensive diseases to society and a rapidly growing health crisis. The committee's decisions in 2017 during the interim have focused on these four proposed areas. One, create volunteer corps of respite workers trained in taking care of Alzheimer's patients so that their families can take a break. Two, expand Medicaid services delivered to people in the home or in assisted living to better Alzheimer's and dementia patients who do not do well in nursing homes. Three, provide resources to local aging services to address the needs of dementia patients and their family caregivers. And four, to begin working on improving the state's adult guardianship system. Do you support these policy proposals and any subsequent bills for the 2019 legislative session, or do you see other solutions that should be considered?
Having helped my wife care for her parents over the last 9 years, the first item of respite workers I see is very critical, and I would very much support that. The fourth item of beginning to work on improving the state's adult guardianship system, I think that makes very good sense to do as well. The second one, expanding Medicaid services, comes back to what I'd said earlier, I think, about the insurance fund. I think we really need to explore innovative ways to see if we can't pay for those services cheaper than just having the state pull it out of their budget, which creates the discussion then about the fourth one, or the third one down, third bullet point, and that is we need to have that discussion across the aisle again about what are the priorities, and is our local aging services our priority, and do we want to fund that? Lastly, what I would say is I think we need to think about this in a slightly different way as well, which is we do have an aging population. We'll continue to have an aging population. I heard today that we will be the fourth oldest population in the country in not too distant future. So what are we doing to attract younger people to Montana and to develop the kinds of jobs that would keep those people here, which would then help reduce the average age of our population? That's not exactly an aging policy, but I think it can help.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
I do support the committee's ideas. The Family Medical and Leave Medical Leave Act helped a lot with people who needed to take time off of work to care for family members, but that needs to be expanded, and especially for people who are caring for loved ones or for patients who need a break, respite workers is a great way to do that. Again, Montana has a challenge. We are a rural state. All, you know, Bozeman is an exception. We are in a city, but there are lots of little towns and small communities and outlying areas where it's not easy to find a respite worker. It's not easy to find transportation for someone who would be willing to be a respite worker. I think those considerations need to be weighed also. The area agencies on aging provide good networks in some of those capacities, resources, support services, and I think they could help contribute to the answer here too.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
Yeah, I mean, based on the proposals in this question, I think this is the type of people we need to be helping, and I would likely support these proposals. But at the same time, you know, the legislature, we need to prioritize that, you know, and sometimes we have to take a little bit, but we need to prioritize this if this is going to be considered important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wendt.
So on this note, my grandfather, and I want to say in 99, something or other like that, he passed away while suffering from Alzheimer's. So I do know, I've seen what it is when you're talking with someone and they just cannot comprehend. I do understand that. I just don't think that we have the science behind it. And I think that when we're talking about these funding levels and the prioritization that Senator Hinkle spoke about, we need to start looking into going deeper, going to those root causes, putting money into research grants, into the university, and to try and figure out how do we actually solve this problem with it, rather than just putting a Band-Aid on it. And that, to me, I believe is the most critical point that we're really missing in the medical, in the healthcare industry and how it's built, is that we're not doing enough time to look at the underneath to see where the foundation's at.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Well, I support all the four proposals, the policy proposals on ways to address the problem or challenge in the future. I was at a presentation on artificial intelligence, which seems far-flung on this issue, but I'll bring it back. They talked about kind of the job loss that was going to occur over time and probably over the next couple decades due to artificial intelligence. And one of the areas where jobs will increase is in personal care and elder care. And I think one of the ways that we can kind of promote that is to raise the status of the people who do this incredibly heart-wrenching job and really difficult job, and reward those people appropriately. Right now, I don't think they get nearly enough credit personally, emotionally, nor do they get enough pay for the difficult and incredibly important job they do. Especially as I look at my later years, I want happy, great people doing that job. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Grubbs.
So as I mentioned earlier, this is personal to me, having had and have two members of my family going through Alzheimer's disease. I agree with all four of the proposals. And respite care is particularly important. My father took care of my mother for about 4 or 5 years at home, and I saw it impact his health as the caregiver because he didn't have access to respite care. And we moved them all up to Montana so we could keep a closer eye, but that's very important. Also, as was mentioned, I think, you know, raising the status, I don't know how fast the AI is coming. I guess pretty fast. So jobs are going away, but personal care is never going to go away unless we have robots. But raising pay and status so we get more people as our population ages to provide those services, I think, is critical. And as Representative Hamilton mentioned, and I've been in insurance 25 years, so I don't know how possible it is, but some way to design a policy that's more affordable for people. My wife and I have long-term care, but we bought it a while back, and you know, it was more affordable then, and it's a lot more expensive now. So just figuring out a way where people can provide for their own care.
Thank you. Mr. Mangini.
Yeah, I think these four suggestions all have some merit to it. I think there'd be a lot of people that would be excited to maybe volunteer to help care for people with Alzheimer's and other dementias. I also don't think it necessarily can be our frontline way of going about it. A lot of the paid caregivers that we have now, they get paid, you know, well, $27 an hour is, I believe, the Medicare going rate for them, but a lot of them only see maybe like $11 or $12 an hour, which, as we've discussed, you know, it's not a lot to live on in a place like Bozeman, Montana, or anywhere. And, yeah, so you don't always get the best people in there. And some of them are harsh. Some of them steal. I've seen this with my grandparents. And so we need to work on maybe having a higher threshold of skill level, I think, for paid caregivers, so that when you do hire somebody to come into your home or you put your loved one in a assisted care facility, you don't have to worry about them potentially being abused. And I also think that the long-term care insurance would be it's a very necessary thing. I did some calling around the past couple of days and realized I'd pretty much, for me, I need to start buying insurance now if I am going to have it by the time, you know, I would need that service. And so we need to be able to have some system where people can buy into it a little later in life.
Thank you. Mr. Pope.
Thank you. I support the four initiatives and agree with a lot of what's being said here. So I'll keep it short. I think the state governments can be interested in structural change. And so to the degree we can help volunteer corps and whatnot, that's great. But I'm more intrigued by the local aging services and how we connect and enable and support financially things that need to happen. I'm also concerned about the financial stress on families. And maybe there's some kind of a tax credit or something that could be given to a family for you know, a very explicit circumstance, have to be well documented and all that. But you know, I hear just anecdotally hear the stories about folks who are having to take care of their elder folks who are really in need, and it's a big stress. So thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
I can tell you on a very personal level of working in nursing homes that this is probably one of the most challenging health conditions that I encounter, and it does wear on the families. The stress is very difficult for them. I support these concepts. I'm particularly drawn to any concept, though, that gives local control, because the issues in Bozeman, Montana are very different from the issues that are in Winnett, Montana. So I like the idea of local control. I'm very in support of one thing that's not mentioned here, but telemonitoring. So telemonitoring is emerging as, I mean, it's just remarkable what can be done now in the home. And in fact, there's federal legislation that would that's being considered right now that would require CMS to pay for telemonitoring services, even though it's not a face-to-face encounter. So there's a lot of promise there. There's also some really interesting pilot studies that are going on where there's telemonitoring that's being used in the home to make sure that the oven's not on and that your loved one isn't wandering around in the street somewhere. And telemonitoring is also being used to record caregiver-loved one interactions, and then that video feed is goes back to a specialist who can coach the family on how to better approach those situations that are going on in the home. So I would also be very much in support of approaches that utilize telemonitoring.
Thank you.
I would also support the four proposals. And it's important with the Medicaid expansion that we vote for 185, expand Medicaid, because the elderly also need to just have their basic needs met, dental, transportation, mental health issues, their medicines. If we don't even cover those basic needs, it's going to be difficult to continue to cover these needs, which we have to cover as well. So we just have to remember it comes the full circle of life. First, we have to cover basic health needs, you know, dental, transportation to get to and from the doctor's appointments, you know, mental health issues, getting to and from appointments. But these four proposals, everybody understands. I mean, these are all key issues, and we're all going to be facing them at some point as well.
Thank you. So we have time for one more question from me, and then we'll open it up to the audience. And this question will be number 5. I'll read it in a moment. We'll start with Mr. Pope, and then to his left. Question number 5. How would you address the suicide and substance use epidemics in Montana as a legislator?
Well, thank you. You know, this is not symbolic, but it's from a data point of view, it's probably one of the biggest massive crisis issues we've got in the state. And it's always just incredibly painful to read about. And it's humbling to associate with family members and others who are struggling. I think it's all of the above. We need more funds. We need more attention. The first thought I had, which is kind of bureaucratic, but it was just, you know, putting together a high level legislative work group to fully deep dive on the issue. So we're not just passing a la carte a couple bills that satisfy. In 2015, we passed a number of very important mental health bills that addressed some of these issues, suicide, substance abuse, but, you know, it was very institutional. It was very, it was a very detailed sort of narrow slice. I think we need to back up and really look at the whole of it. I know that there's, one of the big issues is how to get out into the state. So long and short, you know, there's an initiative up on campus to use the extension services to provide the presence in each of our rural towns. So I'll leave it at that. But there's an awful lot of work to do.
Thank you. Dr. Gillette.
Two really good topics. So that I do work in research and healthcare consulting, but at the end of the day, I'm still a dentist. And professionally, the American Dental Association is the first healthcare organization to come out with strong policy on opioid prescribing. Specifically, the American Dental Association recommends a 7-day dose, so no longer than 7 days, and that mandatory continuing education, which includes really on all addictions, should be a part of a healthcare provider's licensure. And of course, improvements in the interoperability of the state prescription drug monitoring plan. So, making improvements in that. So, I strongly support those initiatives. With respect to suicide, early detection is really key. And it turns out that about 50% of suicide victims have visited their primary care provider within the past month. So there are some really amazing tools that are put out by the National Institute of Mental Health. And I'm thinking that organizations like Bozeman Health or Community Health Partners could use the IHI Breakthrough Series to really move those forward in a reliable fashion within their health core organizations. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Albrecht.
Between 2014 and 2016, 550 individuals in Montana committed suicide. When I worked at Thrive, I used to go into homes. I was working with the high-risk families. So in Bozeman Public Schools, a teacher would call me and say, listen, so-and-so has been coming to school late, same clothes. Parents, we haven't seen them, you know, picking them up from school. You need to get in the home and figure things out. Early education, having a program that's in the school districts right now that goes in and can help those parents and those families at an early age. When you have poverty and you have mental health issues all in the same house at the same time, when these kids are in school 6 to 7 to 8 hours a day, you need to get into that home and work with those families early, early on. And that's where we need to start that, in education, and get in there early. And we have programs in place now for that.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
I'd like to divide this up into two parts, really. One is on the suicide issue. The biggest group where suicides occur in Montana, of course, is in veterans. And I think we need to do a much better job of identifying risks, screening for those risks. And the best way to do that is to have a team approach medically, where it is not just the primary physician, but they have their behavioral health specialist and perhaps counselor along with them. Portland apparently has a pretty interesting telemental health experiment going on, which I think could be very useful in Montana. I think that's being done in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington at this point, but I think those things, particularly focusing on the veterans group with suicide, would be an ideal way to go on that one. Secondly, on the substance abuse side, you know, as Mr. Pope said, I think we really need to move away from the institutional model, get that outsourced a little bit, use groups like Western Mental Health to work with people at an earlier stage in a team approach once again. And as JP had said earlier, sometimes we just have to pay for stuff. And what we have to pay for in this case is education and rehabilitation for folks with substance abuse problems.
Thank you. Senator Pomnikowski.
Well, one thing I think we need to do immediately is to try to reassemble and bolster our mental health services and network that we gutted in a special session. We need to bring that tide back up. Whatever we can do to remove the stigma and the isolation, you know, one of the worst things for someone in crisis is isolation. And where do we live? In a state with just over 1 million people. So whatever schools can do, whatever communities can do, whatever families can do, whatever education we can provide, whatever support we can provide, we have to do that. There is no other option. I was a firefighter EMT for 10 years. And so when I see the substance use epidemic question, one of my first thoughts was, equip your emergency responders. There are states that allow emergency responders to administer Narcan and other life-saving emergency medications for the purpose of reversing the effects of overdose. We are, again, a rural state of first responders. Not everyone's an EMT, not everyone's a paramedic, but first responders, including school teachers and coaches and whoever else can highway patrolmen, whoever can recognize that and reverse the effects can save a life. So I think that's a very specific example, but we can look at more policies that could help in that way.
Thank you. Senator Hinkle.
Thank you. To start out with this question, I just want to address Medicaid expansion again. You know, in 2015, we were told that the program was going to cost, I think, somewhere around $20 to $30 million. By 2 years later, that went up to $85 million. A meeting with Legislative Fiscal Division earlier this year said now the cost is over $100 million and possibly up to $120 million by the session in 2019. So under the current expansion, if I give you a figure of speech, it's like firing a shotgun at the broadside of a barn where all the pellets spread out. And when they spread out, each pellet has very little effect. So again, suicide in Montana, we are one of the highest in the nation, or maybe the highest in the nation. That's a big deal, and it's something that we need to address. So still, we need to focus our aim, and we need to focus on specifics. And if this is something that is a top priority for Montana to address, then we need to address it.
Thank you. Mr. Wendt.
So on October 20th, 2016, my friend Joshua O'Neill hung himself from a tree in Bozeman Pond. In August of 2013, my niece, Melissa Wendt, took her own life in a hotel room in Great Falls. Over the past 3 years, four soldiers in my unit have taken their life for various reasons. This is a real thing. It's happening. I see it every day. I see the struggles every day. And what it comes down to is we need the outreaches. Joshua was a student at MSU. And part of what his death did is he spurred the outreach programs that MSU is doing now. But the real truth of it is that we need to understand more. Knowledge is the most powerful thing that we have. It is the most, it's what the 150 people in Helena can actually do. They can enable our scientists, they can enable our medical professionals to actually look at what are these root causes. What can we do to do? Because the programs, we need them, yes, but we need to cut deeper. We need to look much, much deeper. And knowledge, once it's out there, you can't put it back.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Well, as several people mentioned, I think we do have the highest suicide rate in the country. And I would, in response to that, make mental health a high priority for funding. We're going to have choices to make, and that would be one of my top priorities. I think we also need to explore other options for remote or rural Montana. Suicide rate is high in those locations, and we have almost no mental health services in a lot of those locations. We have a local nonprofit, One Montana, who is working on that, and hopefully they're finding some success, and hopefully we can pursue something like that. As far as the opioid crisis goes, I think there's lots of reasons for why this crisis is occurring. It's economic, it's social change, it's erosion of family and community support, and likewise, the solutions are equally complex. There isn't a silver bullet to solve this. I think as Dr. Gillette suggested, one thing that I would support also is limiting the prescription for acute pain to 7 days, with exceptions for long-term chronic pain. Also, that nobody has mentioned is medication-assisted treatment is proving pretty effective for people that are addicted, and yet we have a million doctors literally in the country that can prescribe opioids, but only 45,000 that are authorized to provide that medically assisted treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. And to our candidates from House District 68.
So I agree with a lot of what Dr. Gillette said as well. I think the seven-day prescription limit and also licensure and continuing ed requirements for providers need to be more stringent, more training, more education, and it needs to be ongoing, not just a one-time thing, so that they know how to recognize and, you know, how to prescribe. Also, the primary care provider being able to screen for mental health issues and maybe give the red flag to support in the communities and families so that they can work with those people that may be prone or susceptible to suicidal thoughts and have those supports available in the community. The other thing I've run into in my prior job was the problems that public schools have in getting CSCT services and the whole financial structure around how that works. You know, being able to get more providers in public schools to work with young people, because there are veterans, it's a big issue. The reservations, it's a big issue. Other populations. But when we see our children committing suicide, you know, that's a young life that doesn't even have a chance to start. So strengthening that system.
Thank you. Mr. Mancini.
Well, both substance abuse and suicide are in a large part diseases of desperation. And I think we need to look at the overarching cause, is that our working class and our middle class, especially in rural areas, are hurting. People haven't really seen a raise in over 40 years. Rent is up, food is up, healthcare and education all cost more. And people are worried about how to pay for it. We need good jobs. We need people to have a hope for the future and a sense of self-worth. And everything else we do, you know, is a Band-Aid and a necessary Band-Aid. But until we address those issues, we're going to have these problems.
Thank you.